I'd like now to welcome Craig Childs. He's an author and naturalist, and he will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow, Wednesday, May 6th, at 6 o'clock. His talk is titled Animal Encounters in the Wild. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hey, thanks.
So I am just learning about your work. You seem to spend an awful lot of time out of doors observing animals. Are you doing so as a writer, as a scientist, a combination of several things?
I think the writing and the science comes second. Primarily, I'm just out there for the experience. I like to move around outside and see what's happening. That's the most pleasing world for me to be in. And you know, then questions crop up afterwards, and I've got my journal with me all the time. So, you know, there are offshoots from what I'm seeing out there. But mostly it's just that I like to be in raw experiences outside, and that's what brings me pleasure.
So you have the book that I'm reading is called The Animal Dialogues, Uncommon Encounters in the Wild, and it's divided into chapters by animal. Do you go out with the intention of looking for a particular animal?
I do, but invariably I find another one.
Right.
I don't see the one that I'm looking for. There are times that you're moving in a certain way. You're moving in like bighorn sheep terrain, and you'd expect to see a bighorn sheep, but then you know you'll be climbing up a crack, and there will be a wood rat sitting there staring at you, and you'll have this sudden eye contact and encounter with a completely different animal, a completely different kind of brain. And so, yeah, I have an animal in mind, but rarely does that animal show up. It's just luck of the draw, and also, you know, the day, the weather, the light, the kind of terrain that I'm in. So I see animals, but I really never know which one it's going to be and when it's going to happen.
It seems that there are always surprises of one kind or another. There was an amazing section about this raccoon that was trapped, and you wanted to help the raccoon get out of its predicament so that it wouldn't die, but you found out that raccoons are very feisty creatures.
Right. It had fallen down into a water hole in sandstone and was trapped down there. And I climbed down and tried a number of different ways to get it out, and finally took a sheet down in and wrapped it up in a sheet and just threw it out of there. And, you know, that's not what I was intending for my day to look like. You know, I looked down in a water hole and saw a raccoon down there, and it was obviously trapped. And I thought, you know, you're not really supposed to be grabbing a hold of a raccoon. And I imagined that it would be kind of a feisty animal, and it turned out to be one that did not want to be dealing with me. And there were, you know, once I was involved, I was committed and had to get it out of there. But there were times that I was going, God, what are you thinking? This is ridiculous. I mean, it really doesn't matter the size of the animal if it doesn't want to be touched. I mean, there's really nothing that you can touch if it wants to be away from you.
And it's funny because there's such a gap between the kind of nature photography that we who aren't in the wild look at, and you know, these animals remind us of our little puppies and kitties and so on, but their behavior is so profoundly not domesticated.
Right. It's the behavior. It's real behavior. You know, it's not really edited. It's just an animal, you know, like yourself, like me, trying to get through its day, trying to do what's necessary, and when it's suddenly faced with an unknown situation, it makes up its own mind. It makes up its own rules. They're different in the wild.
Have you ever found yourself in situations of having, I mean, with that raccoon, it really didn't understand that you were trying to save it. And,
yeah,
you know, it fought back, even though its alternative was certain death. And you saved it, and it ended up eating a slice of your pizza, which I thought was very, very sweet. But have you ever found other situations in which there was some kind of communication in which you felt that you and that wild creature understood each other?
Yeah, I think there have been a lot of other situations. I think the raccoon situation was unusual. Usually I'm not approaching an animal like that. And it, of course, it, it was thinking that I was going to harm it. What else would you think if some large creature came lumbering in on you like that? But you know, I've had a lot of encounters of looking into the eyes of an animal and it looking back, and especially with bears. I've had a number of encounters with grizzlies up in the Arctic where we looked at each other and you could see that, you know, we were talking. We were not talking in English, but talking in an older language of body language and scent and posture, and you just get this feeling, and I've had it with black bears too, and I'm sure a lot of people know what I'm talking about, where you see a black bear out there and you look at it and you say, "Hey, I know you," and the black bear looks back at you and goes, "Oh yeah, I know you too. You know, you're a person. Yeah, you're a bear." There's a recognition of two different species, and I think it can happen on a lot of different levels. You know, whether the animal knows what my intentions are, maybe so. I would imagine that we are constantly displaying our intentions in many different ways without actually saying it.
Particularly when neither one of you is hungry, something else can happen.
Yeah. I like the encounters where we both randomly see each other. Often, you know, if I come on an animal, come through the forest and there's something, you know, there's a deer in front of me, I'll look away. You know, I'll still keep it within my range of vision so I can tell that it's there, but I'll break eye contact with it so that, you know, it can decide what to do next. It can say, okay, the thing's looking away, I'm going to run, or the thing is looking away, I'm going to stay and see what it is. And, you know, that's when it gets interesting, when you look back up and the animal's still standing there looking at you. And it's as if there's an invitation for a dialogue there, where there's an animal that's curious, where, you know, it's not an animal that's hungry, not an animal that's trying to dominate you, or an animal that fears you, but just another person in the world, another thing with eyes looking at you.
It does make one try to imagine what it was like to be one of very few human beings on the Earth. I mean, we're now in the billions, and our life is dominated by other human beings, but it really wasn't all that long ago that there were, a few thousand, a few tens of thousands of people on the Earth, and perhaps that kind of dialogue was as natural a part of life as human language.
Oh, definitely. I think that, you know, you look back at the old stories, and it's always about animals and people speaking the same language, and I don't think that meant that we spoke the same verbal language. I think it means that we have for a long time been talking to each other through every kind of means, through the scents we leave behind and the tracks and the way we approach each other, and I think that we haven't lost that language at all. I think we just, you know, we forget that we remember it. And then suddenly we do remember it. I think that, you know, when I've had encounters with animals, there have been aggressive animals where I've looked at them right away and said, "Okay, listen, you want something, and I'm going to do everything I can not to give it to you." And other times I look at an animal and there is no aggression there at all. It's just another creature, and that takes me back to, you know, that time when there weren't that many humans, when it was just a playing field of creatures. And that's still going on out there. Even though there are billions of us, we all live close together. We're kind of densely packed while animals are moving in this world that rarely we ever see. And you encounter that world and you start talking to them on that level. And I don't mean cooing and, you know, making sounds. I mean talking, like, you know, when I've had close encounters with large predators that I've felt were aggressive, I've, you know, done everything I could to say, "Listen, you can attack me, but I'm gonna do everything possible to stop you. And granted, you have the upper hand, but I'm gonna poke your eye out with my thumb. You know, I'm gonna do something, and it's not gonna be worth your while." And you find a way of telling them that, and you're obviously not gonna say it out loud. You know, the translation might not come across, but they'll see it in your body. They'll see it in the way you're acting.
And you better hope it works.
Yeah, and you got to judge it correctly. You know, there are times that I've you know, in one case, I had a run-in with a grizzly, and it seemed aggressive. There were cubs nearby, and if I was gonna, it was not a moment for me to go, hey, I'm gonna fight back. It was a moment for me to say, okay, I'm just gonna leave now. You know, you don't have to worry about me. You don't even have to think about me. I'm not even here. And you know, you choose how to act. It doesn't always have to be a posture of attack.
We're talking to author and naturalist Craig Childs. Do you, when you're in the wild, ever carry a weapon?
No. I mean, I have a good knife with me. I don't really feel the need for a weapon. And I spent some time in Central Alaska and North Alaska, and people there, you know, some people commented that they thought it was foolish that I didn't have a weapon, but I just thought I'd you know, shoot a bear's paw, and then there'd be trouble. I think you behave differently when you have a weapon. And I think certain animals can see that in you. And for me, I guess I don't think of aggressive encounters that often. I figure if something comes up, if a mountain lion does attack me, I'm probably not going to have time to pull out a gun. My best weapons are, you know, the nearest rock that I can snatch up, or a big stick, or my knife. And I have, you know, I've pulled my knife on a mountain lion before. And, you know, at the same time, I've got a knife in my hand, and I'm thinking, oh, great, what am I going to do with this?
And what happened?
Well, we had a face-off at about 10 feet, and it was trying to get around behind me, and I just kept facing it. And I had a knife out in my hand, and I don't know if that really meant anything. If I don't think the lion related to the knife at all. It was more just looking at my body posture, and you know, finally, when it couldn't get around behind me, it couldn't get to my back, it left.
How did you begin this whole way of living and encountering animals? Were you out in the woods a lot as a child?
Yeah. There are a number of stories in the book that stretch back to childhood, because I did spend a lot of time out of doors, and you know, there were always animals moving around. It was part of my world, and you know, not just the big animals, not just predators, but you know, you'd have encounters with a mouse, with a rabbit, with, you know, just this whole pantheon of creatures. And my mom would take me backpacking frequently, and I'd go out hunting with my dad, and you know, there were always animals around. There were always places to go, and I grew up spending time in the wilderness, and then that eventually translated to an adulthood of a tremendous amount of time in the backcountry, and inevitably you run into things out there. And the way I travel is, I'm not really heading somewhere. I usually don't have a destination. I'm, you know, following tracks. I'm, you know, stalking animals and then getting off of their path and following geology. So I'm just kind of roaming around, I guess somewhat aimlessly. But I'm looking for something. I'm always looking for the next thing. I'm looking for the next track, the next scent, the next wind to come through. So I'm always watching out there.
Well, your observational skills apparently get very well honed. I mean, I was amazed to see a section where you were describing seeing rabbit tracks and then seeing the signs of a hawk, and then a little later on the body of the rabbit being clearly being dragged by the hawk. I mean, most of us wouldn't even see those things, much less know what they signified.
I don't know. I bet if you looked down and you saw what I saw, your eye would be drawn to it. I don't think that I have any, you know, I have a talent based on the time I've spent out there, but at the same time, I don't have anything that other people don't have. That if you were in the snow and you looked down and saw this, you know, incredible design of hawk's wings in the snow, you would stop and stare for a long time, and then after the initial beauty wore off, you would start going, well, what is this? What's this about? And you just start moving around, start following the tracks, and pretty soon a story comes clear. You know, it's like reading a book. it's the same kind of skill. You get to a part in a book that means something that's particularly profound, and you pause there. You read it differently, and you think differently. I think we all have that skill.
Do you prefer going out into the wilderness by yourself?
Oh, half and half. I really enjoy solo time in the wilderness, but I travel. I have a 2-year-old and a 6-year-old, and I travel with them, and they, of course, dramatically change how you see things. You don't encounter as many animals with little kids because they're so loud, and they scare animals away, but then they also bring animals. They have a different kinds of encounters with them, and I really like going out. And I like going out with, you know, people that I know who travel in a certain way. They have a different way of moving than I would. If I'm alone, I'm, you know, going up a certain route. You know, I'm going through boulders. If I'm with somebody else, they take me through a forest. And so I enjoy moving with other people because they bring all kinds of different experiences to me.
What are some of the encounters that your children have had with animals that wouldn't have happened if they hadn't been there?
That's a good question. There was a rattlesnake in our camp. It was last spring in the Sonoran Desert, where my youngest boy and my wife, Reagan, were taking a nap in the tent, and she heard a rattlesnake coming, sliding through the grass, and they both got out of the tent and were crouched in front of it. And then my older son and I came up out of a wash nearby and saw them crouch there, and they signaled us to be quiet, and we crept over, and we were all four crouched, you know, probably 3 feet away from a rattlesnake. And, you know, if it had just slid through camp and the kids hadn't been there, we would have gone, oh, there's a rattlesnake. You know, it changed our experience because we're not, normally we wouldn't really react to it. We would just go, oh, there's a snake. That's cool. Let's look at it. But now, you know, we're going, okay, we've got a toddler who doesn't really understand snakes. And, you know, it changed our experience with it, but we stayed there for much longer than I think we would have. We really studied it carefully, and you know, we're pointing a lot of things out to the kids and pointing out the fact that it hadn't rattled yet, that we hadn't startled it, that it was aware of our presence, but it was still quiet. And just a very different encounter with a rattlesnake than I usually have.
There's also some encounters with animals where you do not necessarily have a whole lot of respect for them, like the mice living in your teepee.
Yeah, you know, right now we've got where I live in western Colorado, just our particular spot, we got an infestation of rock squirrels, and we've been trying to figure out for years what to do about it. You know, it's just like, well, we can kill them because live trapping, you know, we haul out 20 or 30 squirrels and it doesn't seem to change things, and it's like, okay, if we kill them, we got to eat them, and these particular rock squirrels are gnarly little animals, and we have, you know, this adversarial relationship where I walk outside and there one is, and we look at each other. And that's another example of this communication where the rock squirrel is looking at me, and it knows, it can see, you know, that I'm going, ah, you little squirrel, I hate you. You know, you get in our house, you tear up our stuff, and, you know, you have the, it's like a relationship with another person. You know, the mice in my teepee, oh my God, they were everywhere. They were reproducing in every possible spot, and there was nothing that I could do. And you know, I have a basic respect for another living thing, but at the same time, you know, I got my life here. I've got to figure out how to live, and you guys are messing with my life. And it's a hard balance. I don't have just a romantic relationship with animals. I have a complex relationship, like you would with any other person.
Exactly, and when you hate them and want them out of there, you can get into a fight just like you might on any block in a city.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I went after them with machete once, which is not the way to handle mice.
Right.
But I picked up a machete, and I just said, I'm through with you guys, and just started pounding at the floor. And, of course, if mice do indeed laugh at you, that's what they were doing.
The work that you do and the very beautiful and eloquent way that you write about your encounters with animals gives one I've just been thinking about what it takes for people to understand the huge importance of conservation, of preserving habitat and things like that. And your work is very helpful even for those people who do not have the opportunity or the inclination to go out into the backcountry for long periods of time. But how do you see the relationship between your work and wilderness conservation?
Well, in a lot of ways, I'm trying to say that we are not the only ones around. And you know, we get wrapped up in this world where we think we're the only ones. And, you know, I do it, too, as much as anybody. I get jammed into my computer and stuck on deadlines, and there's nothing else but the human world in front of me. And you forget that there's this intense value out there of, you know, other animals living other lives, of, you know, you wouldn't just wipe out other people. Why would you wipe out other animals, other habitats? And I'm trying to hold on to this idea to say, hey, you know, we're not alone here. And if we were alone here, if we got rid of all these other forms of life, or many of these other forms of life, there's not much left for us. You know, it's a very lonely future for us. But even more so, there's a value that goes beyond us, where it's, you know, other living things, where we don't have the right to take away a species. You know, it's why us?
Right.
You know, if ravens start killing off species, which, you know, I'm pretty sure if any animal got in our situation, they'd probably do exactly what we're doing. But do they have the right to eradicate us? Do they have the right to eradicate any other animal? I'm trying to say that there are other worlds out there that we are extinguishing. And I want to make these worlds real to us because, you know, they are real to us. When we encounter an animal, it's a very real experience. It's riveting. It doesn't have to be a deadly encounter with a predator. Anything.
That's right.
Any. I mean, your cat. Your, you know, a sparrow showing up on the windowsill. You know, you see that moment and you go, oh, there's another life passing by.
Craig Childs, unfortunately, it's time to go, but it's been wonderful having you here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Thank you so much for being with us, and we look forward to seeing you at Collected Works Bookstore.
Thank you for having me.
Craig Childs is an author and naturalist and will be speaking at Collected Works tomorrow, Wednesday, May 6th at 6 o'clock. Animal Encounters in the Wild. You can call Collected Works at 988-4226 for more information. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience.